All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck nicks, what the fuckopotamuses? Someone sent me that one. How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show. If it sounds different, it's because I'm not in the garage. Does it sound okay? I think it sounds better. I just adjusted a knob. Sounds better in my head. Did you notice the knob adjustment? Well, where am I? Am I hidden away? Am I in a bunker somewhere? Did I split? Am I fucking out? Am I off the grid? I kinda am. I'm in Canada for two nights, and I got to be honest with you, you know, and I say this with a heavy heart, but I feel fucking relieved, man. I'm just here 2 days and I feel relieved. I'll talk about it. I just was in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Ridgefield, Connecticut. Great shows. I'll tell you about them in a second, but there's something going on this month that you're probably going to hear about whenever you listen to podcasts this month in March. And I feel like I should let you know. I should bring you into the loop. And it's not just this one. It's an industry-wide initiative going on right now called Tripod. And the goal is to enlist you, the loyal podcast listeners, to get other people you know listening to podcasts. That's right. This is we're on a mission. Be pod missionaries. I know this might shock you, but some people still don't get podcasts. It's still a mystery to them. My father, for instance, who I doubt has even listened to the interview I did with Barack Obama. I don't know what he says to his friends or people he knows who bring it up to him, but I'm pretty sure he hasn't. I'm not sure he's listened to one fucking podcast, my dad. But obviously, we're getting into a different issue, all right? Right now, pretty much every top podcast producer is taking the time this month to encourage listeners to get the word out. Tell a friend or a family member about your favorite podcast. Tell them any way you want. And if you do it on social media, use the hashtag Tripod, T-R-Y, pod, all right? And thanks for spreading the word. You know, we're just doing a little push for the medium of podcasting. So yeah, I'm in this very pleasant hotel in Montreal. Oh, by the way, Eugene Levy, speaking of Canada, is on the show today. From SCTV and from many movies, from many things you've seen, from all the Christopher Guest films, the very funny and quirky guy's been at it a long time, Eugene Levy, getting into a little of that SCTV history. And it's odd that I'm doing the intro in Canada. That was not planned. It just happened that way. I flew in me and Singer, Ryan Singer, on the road. He's with me. So we flew into New York on Wednesday, rented a car, drove up to Ridgefield. It was the Ridgefield Playhouse. And it would seem like an old school. Brendan, my producer, Brendan McDonald, met us up there. He drove up from New York. It was a pretty great show. It was a pretty sweet show. It was a packed little room. But the interesting thing about it was, after the show, I'm backstage, and the woman who runs the place, she comes up to me and she says, "Hey, Mark, there's a couple of guys that said they went on a teen tour with you. Does that ring a bell?" And I'm like, fuck yeah, it rings a bell. If it's the guy that took all my money on that bus playing poker with me, I'd like to see him. I went on a barren teen tour when I was like, I don't know how old I was, maybe 14. And these were these tours. Most of them, you know, came out of Long Island. It was like an alternative to camp. You just get on a bus with like 30 or 40 other kids, and you start to really look forward to the places that you actually sleep in a hotel. But I was on a bus for like a month or so with these guys, these kids. There was a lot of us, and I was surprised at the memories that I had, because I've been around a long time, and I've been a lot of places. But why was it so stuck in my head, you know, this particular trip, like this teen tour? Well, I'll tell you why. Because for some reason on that teen tour, I got sucked into a compulsive gambling habit. I was like 14, 15 years old, and there were these kids from Long Island. I know who they were, Craig and Mike, and we would just play fucking cards all the time on the bus. And I lost a lot of money. I lost all the money that I had, you know, for the trip. And I had to wire my aunt so my parents wouldn't know for more money, which I lost to these fucking card sharks, these hustlers, these young, I don't know what professional gamblers from Long Island. And it was embedded in my memory. And I remembered a lot of guys. I remember a few people from that teen tour. So she said they're here, and I'm like, all right, bring them back, because I need to settle a score. And sure enough, in walks, and we're all in our 50s now, Craig and Andy and their wives. And I'm like, I know you, man. I know you, Craig. I know you, Andy. Now, Andy didn't play cards, but Craig did. And I said, you got to be straight with me. Yeah, I know you're surprised that I remember, but I fucking remember, because I think you cheated me out of a lot of money. Now, just tell me right now, was that a rigged game? I got right in his face. And he told me, no, you're just a shitty card player, which is true. And actually remains true. But it was sort of fascinating to see these guys. It's always fascinating to see people. I mean, what has it been? 35, 36 years, 35 years ago, they had some pictures of the teen tour. It excites me whenever I see people that I knew for any amount of time that I remember, and they're still alive and they're okay and they're doing well. That's who I am. That's what, you know, no resentment. Even if he said he'd stolen the money, I wouldn't have cared. But he didn't. Shitty card player. I'm going to have to accept that, right? I'm going to have to accept that. That's just the way it is. So we had a great show. Great show in Ridgefield at the Ridgefield Playhouse. Very enjoyable. It was nice seeing Brendan. He went back to New York. And then Ryan and I, the next day, drove up about 3 hours or so. Got jacked on Dunkin' Donuts coffee. I ate a few donuts. Fuck it. All right, I'm taking the pills. I can eat what I want now. Isn't that the right thing? Isn't that how a grown, aging man with slightly high cholesterol puts things into perspective? I could eat healthy and just really manage things, or part of me could be like, well, every once in a while, why not just go to fucking town? I'm taking the pills, right? Right? I got to live a little. I don't know when this shit's going to end, right? There's a dialogue I engage with. So then we drove up to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. This landscape is very familiar to me. Running that drive from New York to Boston to Connecticut, I did one-nighters all throughout this area all my life, you know, when I was starting out doing comedy. So it was all very familiar, and it's very wintry, it's very crisp, it's very clear. All the trees have shed their leaves, and there's an intensity to it. There's a certain quality to the light and to the air in the winter in New England. It was all coming back. All the feelings, all the confusion, all the anger, all the not knowing of being in college, of starting comedy, of you know, setting out to do what I want to do, and the panic of cigarette smoke and coffee in my shitty VW Golf, running around to unknown little townships to play one-nighters in pubs and bars and grills. And it all just came back. But it's a beautiful nostalgia, you know? As the world around us gets chaotic and dark, sometimes nostalgia is the only thing that can float your heart above the fucking surface so it buoys there, so it's not just sinking like it's stuck to a fucking anvil. We go up to Portsmouth, and it's this little coastal town. I think I've probably been there. I feel like I've done a gig there. I don't know. I don't remember, but it all looked very familiar. And my buddy Jimmy met us in Portsmouth. Now, Jimmy just quit his government job. The last job he had was working in the State Department for flying around the world on the plane with Senator John Kerry, Secretary of State John Kerry. It was exciting to get, you know, the deep the deep understanding of how actually the government works in all its nuanced ways. But nonetheless, Jimmy and I go way back. We go back to college, and it was great seeing him. We did that show last night at the music hall. What a great venue. Been there since the 1800s. Great crowd. But we had a great show. And Jim said, me and Ryan were going to fly to Montreal. We're going to drive back to Boston, fly up. But Jimmy said, let's drive it. So we drove up here through that fucking beautiful winter crisp air. A few snow squalls. Is that what they're called? Squalls. It was great. And I again, bringing it full circle here, I got to be honest with you. We got through customs, and just physically and mentally, I felt a relief to not be afraid of the country I'm in. And that is so fucked up and sad. And I'm only here for 2 days, not like I'm living here, but I did feel a tangible sort of like, all right, the, you know, whatever's, you know, whatever the psychic vibe culturally that's going on in my country is not here. And I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to meditate for a couple of days in this. I'm going to take it in. I'm going to fucking relax for a couple of days. Is that okay? Is that all right with you guys? Next week, I'll be at College Street Music Hall in New Haven on March 10th. Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, March 11th in Troy, New York. Flynn Center, March 12th in Burlington, Vermont. That's next weekend. You want to hear me talking to Eugene Levy? Oh, it's really kind of a, it's always an honor to meet these cats, you know, especially these old, the SCTV people. I still got to get them. I've got a few kids in the hall. I've got a couple SCTV people. I don't have any Monty Pythons. I got to do that too. Let's enter the world of back in the garage. And this is my conversation with Eugene Levy. He's currently in the show Schitt's Creek, which is now in its third season. You can watch it Wednesdays on Pop TV, although our Canadian listeners are scoffing because they've already been watching it on the CBC up here in Canada, where I am. All right, this is me and Mr. Levy. You look excellent. Nice. You look excellent. Very well put together, Mr. Levy.
Do you know how tough it is to find sleeveless sweater vests in this town?
I assumed you got it online. I didn't even know they made them anymore.
I don't shop online.
You like to go?
My son keeps telling me, why don't I shop online? I said, I don't know. It's just kind of a drag to send stuff back. But I think I'm going to start doing that now.
Yeah. Do you like going to the store?
No, I'm not really I don't like shopping.
Right.
I mean, I like looking. I don't like trying on stuff.
Yeah.
You know, because it only makes me feel bad about myself.
Really? I just find it exhausting.
It's exhausting, and pants is like a pain in the ass.
Yeah, yeah. Because you think you're a certain size, and then you're not.
And then you're not.
And you got to deal with that shit.
Yeah, and then it doesn't do up, and then you're thinking, why do I need jeans?
why do I need to leave the house?
Why do I need to leave the house?
Why do I need to dress? How are you feeling about things? You feeling funny in general?
I never feel funny except I'm going to take a sip of water and let it purposely run down my face just to get me in funny.
Oh, there it is.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
No, funny.
Yeah.
I'm not really a funny guy. That's the biggest enigma about me.
Yeah.
I'm not a stand-up. I've never done stand-up.
Right.
I went into improv theater because if I'm going to go down, I want to take some people with me.
Right. Yeah, at least have the protection.
Yeah, I'm not just going up there and blowing it all myself.
Right. Pick up where you left off. You can't look like a total asshole.
I want some collateral damage.
Well, you come from, you grew up in Canada?
Well, you don't have to say it like that.
I could have. I mean, I knew that, so I generally would have just said, "Where did you grow up?" But I chose to insert the information.
But there was something about Canada, the way you said it on your face. It looked like it was you grew up in Canada.
No,
in other words, bracket. You're kidding me.
No, absolutely not. I've had a lot of important Canadians in this garage, important show business Canadians. I've had, I talked to Monty Hall at his house.
Wow.
And he's from Winnipeg.
Lorne Greene, was he?
I missed Lorne Greene. I didn't get the opportunity. I did talk to Lorne Michaels.
Yeah, yes. He's also big.
Yeah, Ivan Reitman I talked to.
Went to school with Ivan.
So what part of Canada did you grow up in? Explain it to
me. I grew up in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, which is about 40 miles southwest of Toronto.
Oh, so it was like a suburb of the city in a way.
Well, it's not a suburb of Toronto. I don't think Hamiltonians would actually love to hear you say that.
I don't want to alienate any Canadians. I might have to live there soon.
Hamilton was kind of the Pittsburgh of the North. It was kind of a steel town.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Is it still?
Nicknamed the Ambitious City.
Okay. So it's sort of like, all right, Pittsburgh, that's a good analogy.
Yeah, there were a lot of steel companies going on in the 50s and 60s, and then they're gone.
Yeah.
No, virtually.
Not unlike America. The industry is gone. What is the, have you been back to Hamilton?
I used to go back to visit family. In fact, I still do. I have some, you know, some aunts and uncles. Well, now it's one uncle. I had two uncles that lived to be 99.
That's encouraging.
I just visited my aunt in San Francisco over the weekend, who is 97.
Wow.
And
powerful genes.
The baby brother is 94.
Her Sid, baby brother?
Yeah, yeah, Sid. He's still golfing.
Yeah. That's great. That's good.
Yeah, that is good. And I had a few other aunts and uncles well into their 90s. But anyway, the trips to Hamilton are getting kind of fewer and fewer. And I still have family back there.
But when something like that happens in Hamilton, is it like here? I mean, does the economy collapse? Is there despair when like the steel leaves?
There's despair generally, I think. No, Hamilton's a lovely city, but it did go through a tough time.
Right.
In the 70s, 80s. You know, it's just... the plants closed, steel closed, malls opened up outside of Hamilton, which took all the business out of the city.
Drained it.
And drained it, kind of, and then it went through a major depression.
And did it bounce back? Is it okay? Is it hip?
Hamilton is bouncing back in a major way.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah. No. A lot of gentrification happening and cafes and a lot of... great things happening, and it's still home of the Hamilton Tiger Cats.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Is that hockey?
No, Mark. Is it? No,
I took a shot.
It's not, but actually, as a guess, it's a good guess, because, you know, because I'm Canada. From Canada.
Exactly.
So hockey would be the major guess.
I thought I was going to nail it.
No. Hamilton Tiger Cats.
What are they?
You know, my friend Joe Flaherty, it's a football team.
Okay, all right.
They used to be part of a 9-member Canadian Football League.
Yeah.
Two of the 9 teams called the Rough Riders.
Yeah.
So the Tiger Cats were, as my friend Joe Flaherty used to say, this is the most ridiculous name for a team he's ever heard. It's like calling a team the Monkey Apes.
Yeah.
But that's Hamilton. Proud to be a Hamiltonian.
But was your family in the steel manufacturing business?
No.
What'd your old man do?
Not remotely. My dad worked in a car plant.
Yeah.
Was a kind of a foreman in the plant. And,
yeah.
Grew up basically doing a lot of physical, you know.
Yeah. Running the line.
He was a working guy.
And your mom?
Working guy. And my mom was a housewife, you know, just managed, you know,
how
three
many kids.
Yeah. I have an older brother. I have a younger sister.
How are they doing?
So they're doing well. I just saw my sister on the weekend in San Francisco, and my brother's back in Toronto.
Anyone in show business?
Well, no. Well, my brother is a producer on our television show.
Schitt's Creek.
I created that with my son.
Really? Schitt's Creek is a father-son operation.
Yeah.
Yeah, and do you both write on it still?
I was writing with him. To be honest, I was in the writing room the first year when we started the show.
Yeah.
Until I realized he can just run with it now.
Yeah. It's all you.
It saves me 12 hours in a writing room.
Yeah.
Trying to crack story. But... So he's running the show now, and he's doing a great job.
And you're working with Catherine O'Hara.
Catherine O'Hara,
genius.
Yeah, she's pretty damn good. We've been working together just for, you know, eons. Great.
Like how many years? Like 40
years?
Well,
40.
Is it 40? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. She started out. She was met, I think. Even before Second City opened in 1973 in Toronto, I was in a production of Godspell in Toronto in 1972.
You were in that mythic production.
It was a pretty good production.
Who was
Godspell.
It? Like, was it Martin Short?
It was Martin. Yes,
was Gilda
Martin
Radner?
Short. Martin also from Hamilton. Martin
yeah.
Short.
Marty oh, is he
and
really?
I went to school together as well.
Yeah.
And so we were the only two kind of Hamiltonians.
You went to high school together?
No. We met at McMaster University, but I knew of Marty in high school because Marty, for a period of time, was dating my sister. So I heard tell of the name Marty Short through my sister back in high school.
Really?
Yeah, when she was in high school. But I didn't meet Marty really until McMaster University.
So what is McMaster? What is that college? Is it a?
You know, it's funny because not that funny. But it's McMaster is just basically was a college started by some Baptists back in the whatever it was 20s 30s something, and majored really in engineering when I was there. That was kind of a big thing. There was no drama course, there was no film course, there was nothing pertaining to the arts.
Really,
it was all kind of extracurricular.
I don't even know what an engineering degree enables someone to do.
Well, you can build a bridge.
Oh, okay. Well, that's important. Yeah.
Yeah, you can build a bridge.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, you would have a rosy future now with all the infrastructure work.
Yeah, that's coming down the pipe. Yeah, it's all going to happen.
In this country. But it was all extracurricular. All the drama, the film, you know, that's where I met Ivan.
Ivan Reitman.
Running the film club at McMaster.
But he was there, so there literally was no arts, yet you met these people that went on to become, tremendous contributors to comedy and art.
We could just make movies and nobody's telling you what to do. Just take a camera and make it the way you want it. It's not like a class where you're passing or failing.
Who was in charge of that? How did that?
Well, Ivan was took it over, in 1966 when I got there,
yeah.
And when he got there, it was kind of an undergroundish kind of film club, right?
But it was about making films, not about watching films.
No, it was about making films.
Oh, okay.
When Ivan took over, he actually formed the club into a money-making venture.
Oh, really?
I think
he told me about
that.
Because
he did have film nights.
Right.
And he had horror film nights.
He'd screen
where
screening.
People would pay money, and you'd have an all-night film festival where films would be bicycled around two or three theaters, and going on all night.
But not these are mainstream movies that he would show for money.
Mainstream movies he would show for money.
Okay.
And then he also started he organized the making of the movies by, having you would have to submit an idea for a film, and the top five ideas got chosen. That's how mine got chosen. And that's when I first met Ivan. We all made our own movies.
What was your movie?
My first movie. I made two movies. My first one was called Garbage.
Uh-huh.
And I worked Garbage for three summers up in Hamilton.
What does that mean, you worked Garbage?
It means you kind of stood on the back of a metal truck in 110-degree heat in the humidity of an August Hamilton summer.
Mm-hmm.
And dumped garbage at your feet and then packed it down so that you got 7 tons of garbage.
Into a truck.
Into a truck, and then you'd go to the dump and unload it and then go back and do it all over again.
So you're what we used to call a garbage man.
Yes, a garbage man. Yes, or sanitary engineer.
Right. You went to engineering school.
That's right.
Yeah. So what was the film Garbage about?
Well, it was a very complicated story. Mm-hmm. Basically, it involved seeing students writing an exam, thinking of what they want to write down as an answer, and then cutting to a bunch of garbage coming out the back of a garbage truck being dumped onto the dump.
That was the tag.
So the theme of it was, because a lot of people still may not quite know what it's about, school was kind of garbage.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was a 4.5-minute movie, no sound. And then I made the first talkie.
Oh, good for you. Finally. McMaster. You broke the audio
first
boundary.
Synchronized sound.
That was
movie.
You. That's amazing. Yeah. I had no idea that I was talking to somebody that had that big a place in film history.
Well,
the first talkie.
You and a nation. Yeah. Yes.
It's weird because a lot of people, I think that was the jazz singer or something, right? That was one of the first talkies.
Well, that was that talkie scored a bit more publicity than my talkie.
Yeah. What was it? What was yours called?
Jack and Jill.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
was it based on the poem?
It was based, although I used the poem.
Yeah.
At the end, as a surprise.
Oh, good.
Yeah, but it was about a bunch of emotionally disturbed. People.
Was it a comedy?
No, although it did turn out to be. It did.
So you shot a serious talkie
yeah.
called Jack and Jill that was not meant to be funny.
That's right.
This was a, well, how old were you, 20?
I was about 20.
So this was a, 20. But this was a serious film.
Yeah, it's a serious film that turned out to be kind of funny. That's pretty much the story of my career. I'd go into audition for movies, for serious movies, yeah. and end up getting laughs at the audition.
So you became that guy,
yeah.
the guy who had to learn that he was funny long after everyone else knew.
Yes, never got the part, but good comic relief for the casting people.
But Jack and Jill, I'm obsessed with it. So it's, what is it? It's early 70s, and it's a serious film. And what was it about?
It was about a guy in a home for emotionally disturbed adults who had a crush on one of the girls in the home and made up a story about the romance between him and the girl, uh-huh. which we actually saw his story. And at the end of the movie, you find out that this story that you think is a real story is he's writing this story.
Oh, right.
And he's actually in this home. And then the other people come in while he's writing it and they take the paper that he's writing and they look at it and it says Jack and Jill and they all make fun of him.
Oh.
And then they recite Jack and Jill.
To him?
To him.
Like together? Like
until
as a
he
chorus?
Dramatically turns and screams into camera, stop.
Yeah. And that's it.
That's it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now that was a feature?
That was an 18-minute feature. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have this digitized? Is this available on YouTube?
Yeah. Well, there is a story which I will not go into here, but I did. I looked for years to
time.
Try and find these movies. Mm-hmm. You know,
your movies.
They were left at McMaster, and then I moved and went on with my life. And years later, I said, I'd love to try and get a hold of the movies that I made there.
Of Garbage and
nobody,
Jack and Jill?
Yeah, and nobody knew.
Yeah.
Anybody going to McMaster, they didn't know. Anything about the film board had ceased to be, everything had stopped. We don't know where the things are. People looked for them. They had no idea. A couple of years ago, not even that, my cousin, who now works at McMaster, said she heard that there was somebody running a film night at in Hamilton
yeah.
where they're showing McMaster movies. And I went, whoa. Well, then give me the name of this guy, and because I want to get a hold of him to find out how he got a hold of the movies, and I did.
He got hold of your movies?
He got hold of all the movies. Ivan's movies, my movies.
When was this?
This was this year. And
oh,
then
wow.
And I got a hold of the guy, and I said, how do I get a hold? He said, well, I'll send you the link. And not only that, he personally went through and cleaned up.
Restored them.
Digitally restored.
The first talkie.
The movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. So now I have them all.
What was it like watching them again?
It was pretty amazing because you're just seeing a whole chunk of your life, really, because the people in the movies are your friends and people you went to school with. And so it's like
time 40, travel.
40, 50 years never quite happened.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And are you in that movie? Are you? Did you play the
no.
role? No. No. Just directed and wrote them.
Just directed and wrote them and provided a voice, I think, in one of the movies. One of the voices is, in fact, Ivan and I voiced a section of Garbage.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have sync sound, so we had to kind of see two people talking, and then we created dialogue that, so it looked like a dubbed movie in a way.
Kind of fit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you go from there? Like how, so that began your relationship with Ivan.
Yeah, that was a good, and Ivan, to be honest, is the one person responsible for, I would say, me being in the business, because when he left to do his first feature in Toronto, when he left McMaster, he left a year before I did, so and I wasn't doing that well because I was doing a lot of drama, I was doing a lot of film, you know, involved with the film board and working on the paper, and I loved it, never went to class.
Where'd you do drama?
At McMaster.
Oh, so they had a
club.
Oh, okay.
With a good director of drama who was brought in from Toronto.
Oh, okay.
And so we actually did a lot of plays.
Yeah?
You know, but there was no course.
Right. Mostly serious plays?
Mostly serious.
You wanted to be a serious actor.
Well, you know, it was the 60s, so there was a lot of those plays where you're crawling on the floor and creating human pyramids and things like that.
Screaming.
Anything but acting, right. I guess.
Yeah, group theater stuff.
Group theater.
Or like, what was it? Like,
or group
theater of theater of cruelty.
Well,
experimental theater.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
The Polish lab theater
sure.
from the late 60s yeah. was a huge influence. So that's what I was doing. And so I really was bombing out of academically.
Yeah.
And realized I had to get a job. So I knew Ivan was in Toronto starting his first movie. I called him to say, Ivan, I'm failing my year. I'm really going under here, but I think I need a job.
Yeah.
I think school is over for
yeah,
me.
Yeah. So you didn't finish?
And he said, no, I never finished. I left school. I wouldn't have been able to pass anyway. I was
right.
so far behind.
Yeah.
And he said, well, boy, if you'd have called me a week ago, I could have got you a job in props. I could have got you a job in, you know, painting or
yeah.
something. But every job is gone. Coffee boy is the only job.
Right.
But I said, great, I'll take it. He said, no, I can't give it to you. I said, I'll take it. He said, no, I can't give it to you. It's really not a real job. It only pays $60 a week. And I'm too embarrassed to give you the job.
Right.
So I said, please give me the job. So that was my first job. And then Ivan's second movie that he did.
What was that first movie?
It was called Foxy Lady. It's
yeah.
a movie nobody's ever seen since the day it was released.
I think he told me about that. Were you in it too?
I was coffee boy on mm-hmm. the movie. And then at the end, he gave me a cameo.
Oh, good.
At the
yeah.
end. Because he knew I did a lot of work at McMaster, a lot of acting work
right.
and comedy. And he thought
sure.
I was funny. On his second movie, Cannibal Girls, a movie
sure.
he was thinking of doing, he said, do you want to be in the movie? Star of the movie, and you can star with Andrea Martin. And I said, great.
Did you know her?
I met her on Foxy Lady. I served
right.
her coffee.
Mm-hmm. yeah.
Yes. So I met Andrea and Foxy Lady, and then we did Cannibal Girls.
Popular movie?
Together. It won some award in Spain.
Oh, okay.
Best horror comedy or
yeah.
something.
Well, that's
but
good.
Is,
that's a
is,
start.
Was it a good movie? No, not remotely. It was mostly improvised and not well, I
yeah.
would say.
Well, it's interesting because out of McMaster's extracurricular clubs, comes the sort of like tour de force of Canadian comedy in a way, that first wave there.
Well, yeah. I mean, Ivan came out of there, Marty Short, myself, Dave Thomas. Doug Henning, the magician.
Sure, I remember him. What was that show he did on Broadway?
The Magic Show.
The Magic Show. I think I saw it. He smiles a lot, kind of hippie.
Yeah,
mustache.
Marty Short used to do a
oh, that's
good
right.
impersonation
that's
of.
Oh, it's the magic is illusion, and illusion is magical, and
yeah,
he's a good character. So, before SCTV. Was the production of, what was it, Godspell, the first thing that brought everyone together? How did that kind of happen?
They just came to town and auditioned, and I auditioned for it. Marty was still writing his finals at McMaster. Marty was in social work at McMaster University. And I called him to say, Marty, you should come in and an audition for the show
because yeah.
it's a musical show. It's like big New York production.
Was he already doing stuff like that, Marty?
At McMaster. He was acting. In fact, I directed Marty in a musical at McMaster called Benji, which was an original musical that was written by my roommate, Bob Sandler.
Yeah.
And a great musician in Toronto, Tony Koznick, did the music
for it.
And so we put it on there. So Marty was performing, but again, like everybody, like me and everybody else that was doing it, you never thought about doing it professionally.
Sure.
It never occurred to me once while I was doing all these plays at McMaster that wouldn't this be nice to do this professionally?
Yeah.
You didn't become an actor. Nobody became actors.
It was just something you were just kind of having fun with?
Having fun with.
And was Marty, could you see the Marty we see now in the Marty then? Was
yeah.
he?
Yeah. Yeah. Same.
Yeah.
yeah. Same impressions. Amazingly good impressions. He was doing that then.
Yeah.
Same voice, same great singing.
So you
voice.
Tell him to audition for Godspell, and what happens?
So he came in and auditioned, and of course we both end up making the final show.
And who else? Who like it had this amazing cast, right? Wasn't Gilda?
It was
in
me
it?
And Marty. Gilda Radner, Andrea Martin, Victor Garber,
Victor Garber,
Paul Schaefer was our musical director. So that was a big show.
But like, it seems to me, like when I talked to Ivan about it as well, that that seemed to be the first, like it felt like something professional and something was happening, and that these talents that all went on to other things and that you went on to work with, that seemed to be the first place it kind of happened.
That actually was our first taste of show business, our first professional show, and meeting some really amazingly talented people. And then, you know, right out of Godspell, Second City opened up. I mean, we were really lucky.
Yeah, timing
being
wise.
In Toronto at that time,
right?
Because, you know, Godspell was a major production coming in from New York, right?
Right.
Great. Second City was the great improvisational company that decided that Bernie Solins, who ran owned the theater, decided to open up a theater in Toronto because they had played Toronto in the mid-60s and got amazing reviews.
Right.
So we just happened to be there in Toronto when Second City came to open up a Toronto theater.
The first franchise.
First franchise. And we got, and that's where I met John Candy and Dan Aykroyd and...
But they were all Canadians, right?
Yeah.
So where did they come in from? You had never met them before. So Second City opens and everybody wants to be part of it. Like people who are performing comedy want to be part of it.
Yeah.
And what was the structure of it? How did it work? How did you get in? Was it a workshop situation
You had to audition. You had
okay.
You had to audition, exercise called Five Through the Door. Five characters. You'd have to create a character, and they'd give you a situation like it's a complaint department at a department store.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody's the person working for the department store.
Right.
You've got in for a complaint, and then you do your complaint. You go through the door. You come back again as a different character complaining.
Right.
And then another character. And then you would go through some improvisations, and they made a choice.
And they cast it.
And they cast. Yes.
Who was in charge of Second City there? Like I don't know. I know some of the history. I mean, I think I talked to Shelley Berman about the Compass Players, and then that became Second City. But like, who did they send up as the guys who knew what they were doing?
Well, Bernie and Del Close.
Oh, Del Close, of course. Yeah. He came up.
Del Close would come up, and Bernie would also come up and work and be involved in directing shows. But he wasn't. You know, he wasn't so much a director,
yeah.
Bernie, as
yeah.
he was just, he owned it.
Yeah, right. but Del was, that's a young Del Close.
Del was pretty amazing. He was an amazing character.
Yeah? Like, how so? Like, what'd you learn from that guy?
You learned kind of how, basically through Second City, this is the great thing about Second City for us,
yeah.
who were lucky enough to get in it. It's a great comedy school, you know.
Yeah.
It just, the shows were intelligent, they were bright, they were really funny, but really smart.
And they were all improvised, most of them?
Yeah, well, the shows were improvised, and then you hone the improvisations down. A Second City show is, I mean, you go and see the actual show, but every scene in the show was created through improvisation and
right.
then honed
yeah.
to the point where we now have a solid piece.
Right.
So then you put all these pieces together, you do your show, and then at the end of the show, you go out and take suggestions from the audience, and you take 15 minutes, you go back, talk about them, how are we going to do it?
Yeah.
And then you come out and improvise the pieces.
With
and,
how many people? Like seven?
Well,
eight?
Five, six,
yeah.
or seven people
sure.
in a cast. And over time, the pieces that you improvise, when it comes time to starting your next show, six, seven, 8 months down the line, you take the improvisations that you were doing that seemed like they were successful, and you go back and try and recreate those improvisations,
uh-huh.
and you start honing those down, and they become the scenes for the next show.
And how did Del, like, what was Del's, like, process?
He just knew what he was doing. It's hard to do, you know, Del was,
Yeah,
that's that. You're doing it right. That's it. Fuck it. It's it's.
But
all right, cat's out of the bag. You're fired.
Structures that were like? Because I know that Del had some exercises and things. Right?
Yeah, it was great. He was great at what he did. He was
yeah.
a great improvisational teacher. Kind
yeah,
of very guru-ish.
Yeah.
And he was there for years. And he was a guy that also had a lot of personal problems and addictions
yeah.
and things. And you
at
know,
that time?
Yeah.
Well, was there a system that you learned from him? What did you learn about improvising from him?
You know, you learn here. The thing about we learned from Dell and certainly yeah. Second City, because it really was a hallmark of the company yeah. since it was created, was just, you know, always perform at the top of your intelligence level,
uh-huh.
which is something you don't think you need to hear.
Right.
But you do. I mean, it's amazing when you hear it, you go, oh, I get it. Because even if you're doing something cheap,
yeah.
play it smart.
You right.
know, if you're playing a cheap character, play it smart.
Right. So don't go for the easy laugh.
Don't go for an easy laugh.
Right.
Just make it smart. Make the laugh smart.
Right. Yeah.
Or if you're creating a character, whatever, make the laugh come out of the character, but make it
right.
You know, don't just throw it away and
right.
step over the line. And,
right.
So never think you're smarter than your audience. And,
right.
And so. Those are guidelines that we anybody in Second City goes on to use for the rest of your career,
sure.
basically.
So in that first crew, it was you and Aykroyd and Candy.
The first company in Toronto was at a different theater,
right?
And that was yes, Dan Aykroyd, Valerie Bromfield, a great, very funny writer performer. A couple of local people, Joe Flaherty, Brian Doyle Murray,
yeah.
Bill's brother.
Yeah.
And that was the company. And then it closed because it didn't have a liquor license and people just got tired of having crepes and Cokes.
Okay.
So they closed.
Yeah.
It only stayed open about 6 months.
Yeah.
And then it was reopened at the old Fire Hall in Toronto. And John and me and Joe were in that company. When John got hired,
yeah.
John Candy got hired for Second City. They sent him down to Chicago. That's how good they thought he was. Dell wanted John Candy in Chicago, in the company with Bill Murray.
Uh-huh.
And
so that was already going? Bill was already down there?
Bill was in the company, yes.
Yeah. And they wanted John?
Yeah, they wanted him in Chicago.
What was amazing about John when you first met him? Like, he was just
funny.
Yeah.
I mean, he was funny. He kind of, you know, had a very cute, adorable face.
Yeah.
John wasn't that heavy.
Initially
back then,
yeah,
you know, he was kind of plumpish,
right?
Nevertheless, it was okay to do fat jokes,
sure.
kind of back
yeah.
then, and
yeah.
he was the guy leading the charge,
right?
You know, that's
it was almost seems like that the model of it's weird when you look at these sketch troupes that or these improv troupes that later created all you guys, that there almost seems to be a type. You know, that there's a commedia dell'arte element to it, that people fall into a role, like, you know, like the sort of bombastic, slightly heavy guy is sort of thematic throughout, you know, all of these groups. You know, they like, it seems like Belushi yeah. and Candy were kind of the beginning of it. And then
yeah.
you get this legacy of that. Maybe I'm just romanticizing it or mythologizing it, but because I see all you guys as like these archetypes of what is now like, you know, sketch comedy, and everybody comes out of improv now, you know, more than stand-up.
Yeah.
There was a while there where it was stand-up heavy, and now it's all about those models that were created at Second City that now sort of guide show business.
Yeah, although that's true. Although I think SNL really still kind of, there's still a lot of stand-up that gets
sure.
people going into SNL still come out of stand
yeah.
up, although they have been coming out of the committee or
yeah,
UCB or
the Lampoon
right.
back in the day. The committee is not that was a long time ago. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
that's how our show got started in Toronto because SNL when they started in 1975.
Yeah,
really the two groups were Second City, and National Lampoon.
Right.
And Bernie Solins, who ran Second City, saying, boy, we're gonna have our people just draining right out of Second City, going right into SNL. Let's stop this here. Maybe we should have our own show.
In Canada.
We started in Canada because
right.
I guess most of us, John and Joe and myself, were in Canada doing Second City Theater.
And Marty?
Marty came in later.
So the idea was to counter SNL and create a show there, to
yeah.
hold on to talent.
Yeah. Why should Saturday Night Live be taking all of our Second City talent? Why don't we have our own show where Second City can funnel, you know,
right,
talent going
in? I think
in?
National Lampoon felt that way, too. Like, I've heard stories that, you know, it was just the whole format was just pilfered by Lorne from Lampoon and just drained everybody out.
Well,
it's a conspiracy theory.
It's funny. Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, Ivan, I was with Ivan when we first saw the National Lampoon touring show with
Belushi.
With Belushi and Harold Ramis and
Bill
and Gilda.
Yeah.
And it was a really funny show and, you know, out there. And
you saw it in Canada?
Edgy. Saw it in, yeah, they came up to Toronto and played a club in Toronto. And then Ivan went back and talked to, you know, the cast. We all did. Yeah, great show, great show, great show. Next thing you know, Ivan is working out a deal with Matty Simmons to create a permanent club in New York so this group can perform permanently.
Matty Simmons from National Lampoon.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Right.
Which is amazing when you think what Matty Simmons owned and why would he need an Ivan.
Right.
And yet...
He did it?
Ivan was went into partnership with Matty. And then out of that, of course, came Animal House.
Right.
And, you know,
Ivan's
and the rest.
Career. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right. So you guys, it's Bernie's idea to do Second City first? Second City TV, SCTV?
Yeah.
And how does that start to unfold?
Well, we got together. We just said we got together with Dell was involved, Harold Ramis, myself, Joe, Dave Thomas.
Yeah.
And we kind of brainstormed the idea of a television network where we could do TV parody.
Right.
And make it like a programming day.
Right.
And that was the idea.
With the behind the scenes and the bits.
Yeah, behind the scenes, we wanted a storyline running through the show. And I can't honestly remember whose idea that was. It could have been Bernie's.
Yeah.
Or it could have been Harold's.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was it. So that storyline through the show created was really...
the context.
A key thing
yeah.
for our show.
Sure.
Because instead of it just being a series of sketches, we had a storyline where we needed some characters who worked at the station to carry some of these storylines.
Right.
Like Johnny LaRue.
Yeah.
John Candy's character.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was Flaherty's character's name? The owner of the station?
Well, Guy Caballero.
Yeah, yeah.
And that came out of an improvisation on the floor in front of the camera. Harold Ramis, one of the smartest, funniest guys
yeah.
that I have ever met, may he rest in peace, was doing a character called Mo Green in the first season of our show. He was the station business manager.
Yeah.
Or the manager.
Yeah.
And a kind of a Weasley guy, and he did a show called Bowling for Dollars.
Yeah.
And he would take calls on his Bowling for Dollars, and we would, in the first season, improvise a lot of these things. So Joe got on the phone with Harold on camera, saying, "Who am I talking to?" And he says, "Green, this is your boss, Guy Caballero."
Yeah.
And you could see Harold laugh on camera.
Right.
Because it's a play on Gay Caballero.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so that's where that character started.
Yeah.
In an improv, and then he became the boss of the station.
So the whole idea, which made it different from SNL in a way that was probably more easy to refill, was you had this whole umbrella, which was the network, so you could just, that was in place. So it was just a matter of creating characters, satirizing existing people,
yeah.
and just moving them through this network day.
Yeah, it was a great format
for
a show for kind of poking fun at TV, news programs and dramas and comedies and sitcoms and whatever.
I remember having to watch it like it wasn't on here until later. Like it was after.
On 1 o'clock or something.
Right. And yeah. that was as it was happening, because when I was in a teenager, I would watch it. But that was current. It wasn't like we weren't watching it after the, like it wasn't, to, hadn't run it. I can't remember what years
well,
those were. What years were they?
Oh, it's 1976.
Okay, yeah.
76, so. 77, we were doing half hours. 78 was still half hour. And we got syndicated in our second year, a syndication company picked us up and syndicated our show in, I think, 40 U.S.
Right. That must have been when I was watching it. Late at night.
And it came on
like after
SNL. Or maybe it was Friday night. I can't remember. But I think it was after SNL. 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right. And then there were those of us who were kids who were sort of like, this is its own thing. You know, like it had its own following and it was clearly different.
It was like when Python came on the scene and we would watch Python and it was like, wow,
where'd that come from?
Foreign. Is this weird? I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, exactly. I remember seeing like Martin do Robin and, you know, and then the whole backdrop of all these other characters, the weird. What was that Abbott and Costello bit I was trying to remember?
Well, we did a piece called this will mean probably nothing to the listeners because these are shows that are going back, but we did a show called the Midnight Express Special.
Yeah.
There was a show on NBC, late night music show called the Midnight Special.
What was that guy's name?
The Midnight Special with Wolfman Jack.
Yeah.
And then the movie, Midnight Express.
Right.
So we combined the Midnight Express special as the Wolfman Jack show.
Right.
Hosted by Abbott and Costello, but the idea of the storyline through Midnight Express of somebody trying to smuggle
heroin or
dope
hashish,
or heroin, hashish.
Right.
Into the country or get it out of the country, we incorporated into the Abbott and Costello routine. So we did that. We sometimes took a couple of things, mixed them together, but by the same token, our show was a post-production show. We did have the opportunity to write the show, first, or at least get the writing started and then shoot the show. And then we were involved in the editing and
there wasn't an audience.
No,
I think that was the primary difference that you
just
noticed.
just playing to camera. And that is the primary and always is the primary difference. If you're performing for a studio audience, you want to get a response from the audience, and to get the response from the audience, your performance has to come up, and that's where you get sitcom. The performances are elevated
right out of vaudeville,
comedically heightened.
Same with SNL, right? And you guys were
We play right to camera, so we could keep the subtlety of what we're doing right into camera.
Right, and hold the characters a little harder.
And hold the character, and they did add a laugh track to the show, which you know, couldn't do anything about it, really.
Oh, really?
Well, we tried in our very first show in the first season, we thought, we don't want a laugh track. We just want this to play without a laugh track.
Right.
And we cut the show together and looked at it, and it just seemed like it was laying there.
Right. Where there should be laughs.
Oh, we need a laugh.
Yeah.
So then we brought in an audience and we played the show for the audience and recorded the audience.
Yeah.
But that wasn't good because the audience would laugh, but they would laugh over another line. Like they'd laugh over a joke or laugh line.
Sure.
The laughs were coming in weird places.
Right.
So we said, all right, get the guy with a machine. And so he, you know, he would...
He would
do as good a job as he could.
So the original crew of the first season, like, how was that? It was you, Candy.
The first season was we started the show with Joe Flaherty, John Candy, myself, Dave Thomas, Catherine O'Hara, Andrea Martin, and Harold Ramis.
Right.
In our third season, 78, 79, I think somebody didn't come back. Catherine was gone that season. John Candy was gone. So they brought in, that was the season Rick Moranis joined the show. And then they brought in Robin Duke and Tony Rosato, also passed away this year.
Yeah.
So they were in the show for one season.
Okay.
In the half-hour format. And then when we came back in the 90-minute format on NBC... Joe, John, me, Rick, Dave, Andrea, and Catherine.
And is that when the Great White North thing started and all that stuff?
Yeah.
The thing started to stick. Who was producing that one? The hour and a half one.
Well, we had, as a creative producer, you mean? We didn't.
What was on? It was on NBC.
was on NBC, and we had executives from NBC who hated coming up to Toronto.
Yeah.
Well, not only Toronto, we were also shooting the show in Edmonton. When we started the 90-minute show, we were in Edmonton, Alberta, shooting the show.
I know that place.
So nobody wanted to fly up to Edmonton, so the executives from NBC would fly up occasionally and you know, just say, hey, why don't you put your A material up front, like we do on SNL.
Yeah.
Put your A material up front, and then the middle portion, you know, do your material, which is okay. The experimental stuff.
Yeah.
Put that at the end.
Yeah.
You know, because the demographics are, you know, the audience is, we're getting good numbers in the first half hour, and then it drops a little bit. Last half hour, you don't want to worry about it. So we say, oh, interesting, interesting. And they'd go back, and, you know, we just kept on doing what we're doing. Always ignored them.
Yeah. How long did it last in that form?
3 seasons, 90 minutes, and then our last season was, we were on Cinemax. And there was just 4 of us on that last season.
Oh, really?
So we're getting into some indulgent stuff in our last season.
So it was a good run.
And it was a good run, and you know what the thing was? Like, the inmates were running the asylum.
Sure.
We really had nobody telling us what to do, and and we got spoiled a little bit that's not the way shows are run, and chances are you'll never get to do that again. But although we're having a pretty good shot at it with our current show, Schitt's Creek, but you know, it's great when you can do what you want and you don't have to do something you don't want.
Yeah. And you have a bunch of friends with you.
And you have a bunch of friends with you because we did. We worked together. We partied together.
Yeah.
And it was like a dream, really.
Were you ever considered for SNL? Was that something you thought about doing? Or
I may have thought about it.
Right.
But I never...
You were never summoned?
I was never summoned. I remember 1 year Lorne Michaels came up to when we were doing Second City stage or filling in or whatever.
Right.
And I know Joe and John did some stuff like audition pieces on a thing, but they didn't get hired.
But it's interesting, all you guys, like a lot of you certainly had good careers in television, and you know, obviously you're still going. John did some big movies.
Yeah.
Joe had recurring roles for years. Everybody did good.
Yeah, Joe's on Freaks and Geeks. Marty's, you know, just still going strong. John Candy had a great film career.
Yeah.
I think John was like the biggest star. He was became a major film star.
Yeah.
Did some great work.
He did, yeah.
Great work.
Funny guy.
And, you know, we're still going. I went through, I think, got into some directing stuff in the late 80s. You know, I got
in Canada.
Some in Canada, one feature film that I did here. It was actually shot in Europe, but for Dino De Laurentiis.
Oh yeah. What was that?
It was called Once Upon a Crime.
Uh-huh.
And it was a feature that we shot in Rome and Monte Carlo.
Was it? It was a comedy.
It was a comedy. Yeah, it was like a kind of a farce. John Candy, Jim Belushi, Sybil Shepherd, Sean Young.
Oh wow!
George Hamilton.
And that was your first big movie directing?
Well, that was my first and only feature directing. No story there. I think that says it all, doesn't it? But it actually was really funny. It was a funny movie. It had some very funny moments.
Yeah.
It just got a little it got a little weird. We couldn't quite get the third act going. They hired writers, some big name writers and stuff, but still couldn't
crack
get going. And then you know, there were some few issues with Dino.
Dino?
Yeah. You know, I actually liked Dino De Laurentiis. He had a reputation, like, you know, I'd heard before I started working on that movie that, you know, some directors would just, in their contract, they say, no, he's not allowed on the set.
Yeah.
And when we started the movie, he was, you know, he was so great. He was like a second dad.
Yeah.
He was just great. He was fun. He'd like to laugh.
Uh-huh.
the scouting trip in Europe was an experience in itself. Uh-huh. It was just first class all the way down the line. It was like first class hotels. He would take you out to the best restaurants. It was, you got along great with him.
Yeah.
We started the movie, everything was going great, and then things just, you know. We got into some issues about the script and what he thought was funny and what I didn't think was funny. And while I was over there in pre-production, Dino was still in Los Angeles, and we'd have some screaming matches on the phone.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I mean, screaming matches where he would be faxing pages that he got some guys to work on for free. And, you know, this is a good joke. That's a good joke. The woman here comes by with the big boob and, you know, walking across. Dino, I don't think it's funny. What? You know, screaming. To the point where when he finally did come over, when we started shooting, I met him in his hotel and I had a stick with a white flag on it. And
oh, really?
Waving my white flag. And
did that work?
It worked for about 10 minutes.
Yeah. I think Belushi did him on SNL, I think. Wait, didn't he? Belushi's like, my Kong, talking about the King Kong movie.
I think, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
I hadn't even thought about that till you just mentioned it.
So when did you move sort of down here and start, you know, doing that?
I would come down sporadically for a lot of different projects. When we, first time I came down, honestly, was for anything serious. We did a Second City in Pasadena in 1975.
Right.
But
a live show.
Live show. That was my first trip to California.
Right.
In 1980, we came down to do a movie called Going Berserk with Joe Flaherty, John Candy, and myself.
Yeah.
A movie that David Steinberg directed.
Sure.
And it was not much of a script I remember at the time. And I was in Toronto, and Joe and John were down with the writers working on this thing, and I'd say, hey, send up some pages. we will when we get it down, you know, which is not ready yet, but we're working on it. But boy, there's a great part for you, and there's some funny scenes. Great. Yeah. A month later, because send up some pages.
Yeah.
So I can read, we're almost there. We got something. Next thing you know, I'm flying down to Los Angeles. They're shooting in a week.
Yeah. No pages.
I've already signed. Still waiting. Yeah. And they said, well, come down here. We'll give you the thing when you get down here.
Yeah.
And so I got the script. I went back to my hotel. I got into bed. I turned on the lamp, started reading, got to page 15, called my lawyer. I said, oh, my God, Ted, this is horrible. I mean, what are we going to do? The script is horrible. It's garbage. I can't do it. I can't. Do it. I love the guys. I can't do it.
What was the problem? Were they partying, or they lost?
It just wasn't good.
Yeah.
Let's put it that
okay.
way. It just wasn't good. So I went in to, so my lawyer says, well, you know, we'll go in, we'll take a meeting with David Steinberg in the morning. We went in and had the meeting, and he said, so Gene, I understand you have some problems with the script. I said, well, Dave, honestly, I don't think it's ready. You're shooting in a week, personally, and I know this means nothing to you. I don't think it's ready. I don't think it's ready. It's not. It needs a lot of work. And
of course it needs work, Gene. But, you know, this is not the movie we're shooting in a week. We're constantly making amends to the script. And tell you what, why don't you stick around for the week and work with the boys and redo the scenes you feel like you want to redo? We're not doing this.
Yeah.
It's going to be much better by the time we start shooting next week. So stick around for the week and see what you can do to help things. So we leave the meeting, and my lawyer says, okay, you know what? Just do the movie, because you're not going to come out of this smelling too good if I have to go and tell the studio that you've decided to back out at the last second.
Right.
You know, even though the director said, yes, you can leave now, but if you, stick around and work on it. And if you don't like what at the end of the week, then you can just go back and leave.
Yeah,
he said, that's not going to happen.
Right.
So just do the movie. And I did. And it was great fun. Not a great movie, but it was actually,
a very cultish kind of movie. So many people have come up and said, Going Berserk is insane. Yeah. And I said, it is.
That, what year was that?
That was 1980.
Yeah.
And then in the Splash was 83, and then I'd come down and do that. And then, you know, we traveled to Jamaica for Club Paradise in 84, and then I was back in L.A. in 85 to do Armed and Dangerous.
Right.
With John Candy. And so my trips were
frequent.
I would come down and do work down here for years. And
you and John were real tight?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you and Joe?
Yeah.
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 It's good.
Still see Joe. Still see the people. We still see each other on a semi-regular basis.
That's nice. Marty.
Marty, of course, all the time, because, you know, he's my oldest and dearest friend. I mean, we
do you live by each other?
Yeah, we're 1 minute apart.
Oh, so yeah, so you're around.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, 1 minute apart. Marty's probably the funniest guy in show business. I don't think there's anybody faster. I don't think there's anybody who's got a faster mind than Marty. And case in point, Jiminy Glick, if you love that character.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is just off the cuff, and it is absolutely brilliant. Yeah,
he's amazing. You know, he transcends, you know, show business almost.
Yeah, yeah.
He embodies it and transcends it.
He definitely embodies it, and he is the anchor to, I mean, he knows everybody in the business, and everybody loves him. And
so how did you get involved with, because I think like most people, like now, maybe that's not right for me to say, outside of American Pie, which is a franchise you've been connected with for years.
Yeah.
Like there's like 12 of them now, right?
Well, no, not 12. No, not 12. 8.
Okay. But that's a good gig.
The gift that keeps on giving. It was it was a good gig. Four theatrical features and four straight to DVDs, and that was great.
But the Chris Guest movies, who you work with Catherine a lot.
Catherine, Fred, yeah. Fred Willard, great cast, and Chris, of course, who's comic genius. How did I meet Chris? He called me. I knew of Chris from going back to Lampoon, and you know the radio shows and the albums. And I would hear. I knew Gilda was doing work there, and Schaefer was doing work there, and Bill Murray. I knew those voices, but there was one voice that I'd never heard, Chevy. One voice that I'd never heard, and that was Chris.
Yeah,
and it was brilliant. His character work was astonishingly great. And I kept saying, "Who is that guy? Who is this guy? Yeah. Who is this guy?" I got a chance to work with him on a Billy Crystal special in the mid '80s.
Yeah.
Not working directly with him, but I would, when he was shooting his stuff, I would go make sure I'd go and watch.
You're a fan.
Huge fan. And then years later, I get a call. I'm in Toronto, and I get a call, and it's Chris. And he says, I'm thinking of doing a movie, and I'm wondering if you would like to come down and write it with me. And I'm thinking, I don't even know the guy. I met him twice.
Yeah.
How many people turned it down before you called me? So he said, yeah, I've got a cabin up in the northwest region of the country, and we could go up there for a week. I'm thinking, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And in my mind, in milliseconds, I'm thinking, I'm trying to work it out, thinking, okay, how this could be great, or it could be horrible, or it could be, I don't know the guy, and this is great, now we're in a cabin, and what if it's not working?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'll just go back to the airport.
Sure, what do you got to lose?
That's it. So I flew down to meet him there, and from the first second he picked me up at the airport, it was just laughs and just great. And that was the beginning.
Isn't that interesting, though, like out of nowhere, a guy that you respected so much, and that you had no real sense that he knew what about you.
Right.
Like, you know, why you?
Well, you know, it was years later, almost at the end of our run.
Yeah.
When I put the question to him, Chris, why did you call me that day?
Yeah.
Who did you approach? How many people did you approach before you went? He said, no, you were my first choice.
Yeah.
I said, based on I was a fan of your show, SCTV, and in particular, loved your work on the show. So I called you. I went, boy, I wish I'd asked you that in the very beginning, because I always thought I was number 9 on the list.
Why would he stay with you for 4 movies?
The first one worked out, but, you know, it was kind of an odd thing. Yeah, Chris is very, very funny and insanely funny.
Yeah, it's transcendent. There's something about, you know, his commitment to things that's really amazing.
Yeah.
His sensibility is like, it's completely unique.
Had some great laughs putting those.
But you co-wrote like 4 of them, right?
Yeah.
Guffman, Best in Show, Mighty Wind, For Your Consideration.
Yeah.
You were with him. Now, what do those scripts look like? Are they?
Well, they're outlines. They're pretty detailed outlines that got more detailed as we went along. I think the script for Guffman was maybe 15 pages.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we lay out the story from scene to scene.
Yeah.
Scene to scene, we lay out the story and we kind of, we describe what exposition has to come out in every scene to keep the story going. The movies are improvised.
Right.
So we don't really write dialogue. If we thought of something funny as a joke, we would put it in the outline.
Right.
And hope the character uses it.
Right.
But it was just really keeping the story moving from scene to scene, because you've got to have an anchor that if you're improvising a movie and it's just a free-for-all, then good luck. It's
hard to put together.
Hard to put together. So you've got to have something that keeps the story moving, and that's what we did. And with every movie, we got more involved in character backgrounds and
actually writing those out.
Writing who the characters were, where they went to school, what books they wrote. For the actor.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And did they appreciate that?
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, sure. Yeah, and sometimes they added to it. And sometimes in a major way added to it.
And then there's a sort of ensemble sort of started to reveal itself through those movies. Like there were core players that seemed to be in a lot of the movies.
Yeah, we started out, I mean, Guffman was just Catherine, myself, Chris, Fred, and a very talented improvisational actress in Toronto, Linda Cash. Who played my wife in that movie Waiting for Guffman, and it was and Bob Balaban, of course.
Balaban,
and that was kind of the core for Guffman, and then it just expanded with Best in Show. We brought in Jennifer Coolidge,
Jane,
who I had seen. I didn't work with her, but I saw her when American Pie came out, and I recommended her to
She's
Chris.
Great. I just talked to her. She's astounding in a way.
Really, really great and quirky and funny. And Jane Lynch.
Great.
And then Michael McKean.
Yeah. And that was for Best in Show.
And Michael Higgins.
Oh, yeah. He's interesting.
John Michael Higgins.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was that. And those movies were, honestly, just a lot of fun. And Guffman, we had more. We didn't learn soon enough, but on Guffman there were a lot of scenes that we would laugh in the middle of a take.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't help it. There were scenes where there were group scenes where I would drop slowly behind the person in front of me on my hands and knees and crawl off the set
right
while they're still shooting, so that the scene would go on and I couldn't stop laughing. And
the experimental theater experience paid off.
Yes, it did. Crawling. Yeah. Don't be afraid to get the tummy dirty. And then we learned that, you know, because it is improvised, you know, if you're laughing through something that's really funny, chances are you're never going to quite get that moment again.
Right.
So it was.
So you figured out a way to crawl.
Well, we learned. Yes, crawling became a big thing. Always make sure you're near somebody that you can move behind.
Right. So you didn't lose that.
That's
perfect take. Well, like in Mighty Wind, that relationship that you and Catherine O'Hara had was like, outside of it being funny and tragic, it was really deep.
Well,
I think that comes through with a lot of his movies, that where you have these amazing characters in this vibe, but the maybe it's the backstory, maybe it's the performers, but Jesus, man, I mean, they're moving.
Chris and I share that. The one thing that made us work well together is we share that sensibility of not being afraid to kind of bridge that line between comedy and drama.
Right.
Case in point, A Mighty Wind.
Yeah.
You know, we were coming up with evolving the characters for the show, and we're talking about Mitch and Mickey, our two characters.
Yeah.
And the fact that they were the sweethearts of the folk music.
Right.
Generation, and their big hit song was Kiss at the End of the Rainbow, and they would sing the song and then kiss at the end of the song. Well, now we have, years later, a reunion, and in the history of these two characters, they had a horrible split up and a horrible divorce and a horrible fight, and they never saw each other, and Mitch went into sanatoriums,
right,
and
sure,
just
yeah.
drugs lost and yeah. lost it and became weird.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
She remarried. Well, what's going to happen when they come back to the reunion and they're going to sing their hit song? How are these two people going to kiss? Are they actually going to kiss at the end of the end of the song? Because they hate each other.
It. Yeah.
And we kind of had a moment where we realized, wait a minute, this could be the storyline, the A storyline
yeah.
for the movie. But how scary is that? We're writing, this is a comedy.
Yeah.
And yet we're gearing this movie toward a third act where, are these two people going to kiss at the end of the movie?
Right.
What are we getting ourselves into here?
Right.
This could be horrible, because if it doesn't work, I mean, if the audience isn't there with you, then it's going to be it's going to be an ugger.
Yeah.
And yet we both felt compelled to move in that direction because it seemed like the most exciting way to go in terms of a story. So
right.
it's that line between comedy and drama that has always been my comedic raison d'etre, kind of. You know, it's the most exciting way to do comedy for me, because I'm not a joke person, as is evidenced, for the past hour and 10 minutes.
Well, no, but I don't know if that's true. Like, you know, even like your sensitivity to characters, like even like with Bobby Bittman, you know, back in the day, which was a spoof on, you know, that generation of stand-up, you knew what wasn't funny and how to make it funny. I mean, I think you do, you know, I'm not that you need me to tell you that. I do think you have an understanding of
yeah, comedy. No, it's an understanding. No, it's true. But the kind of comedy for me that from the very beginning is character-driven.
Sure.
So even on SCTV, it's always character driven,
right.
And as broad as some of the characters were on SCTV, we committed to the characters. We never had a joke at the expense of the character or stepped outside the character.
Right.
No tongue in cheek stuff.
Right. That's right.
So that's always
a big difference.
It's always been important. Edith Prickly, big broad character, and yet Edith Prickly Prickly, that's who she is.
Maybe that's some of that stuff that came from that instruction, in a way, of Del saying, you know, keep it intelligent.
Well, that's it. That drives that is the driving force behind everything. Make it intelligent. But to me, making it intelligent also means just making it three-dimensional.
Yeah.
Make a character funny but real. Make him, you know, you should be able to take an audience on a much more kind of rewarding trip.
Yeah.
Than necessarily just, you know, kind of
jokes.
Laughing. You know
well,
what they, I mean?
And the way you guys played that out in Mighty Wind with, you know, it becoming, now that you say that, it became the A story in a way, that whole third act where all the other performers are like, I don't know what's going to happen, right? It was like,
yeah, very emotional moment.
They were all moving towards it.
Yeah.
And they brought the audience with it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they come in and they move into the wings to see, are they going to do it? And then they can. It really was an amazing moment that you could actually feel.
I'm getting choked up now.
When we were actually shooting it.
Oh, yeah?
You could feel it.
Because
I remember looking into the wings and seeing Parker Posey with tears in her eyes while the camera's there and I'm doing the scene with Catherine. So It was great. And that's the kind of comedy that I
sure.
love, yeah. you know, and that's what we were doing on our movies with Chris.
Yeah.
Make the characters real. I mean, the characters, the audience has to be able to grab hold of something,
sure.
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you do it successfully, then you can take them on a nice ride.
Sure. And you're doing that now with the
exactly what we're doing in Schitt's Creek.
Schitt's Creek. And then you have this dynamic, I imagine, with Catherine that is like, it's weird when you do have genuine, you know, decades of history with somebody and you know their emotional nuances as performers,
yeah.
that there must be a comfort level to that.
Yeah, amazing comfort level. And we kind of know, we have the same approach to our work, Catherine and I. We take it kind of very seriously. Approach our work as actors approach a character, and we kind of have a sense where somebody is going or could go, or you know, so we work very well together emotionally on that level.
Well, it's sort of interesting that you know that like when you talk about it, like it's some sort of magic, you know, because when you really think about the show you're doing with her now or these Chris Guest movies, which are more subtle than I think SCTV, is that, you know, you're not really playing, you know, the confidence you have to have in the character to not play for laughs, but to assume that they are comedic characters innately is some sort of gift. I mean, you guys kind of invented some of that.
It's just a commitment to character work.
That's
really all it is. For me personally on Schitt's Creek now, and I should for your listeners mention that it is Schitts.
And it's on
it,
Pop.
It is a person's name.
Pop TV?
It's a real name. And it's on Pop and Netflix.
Yeah.
You know, this is
commitment to
this
character.
This is a commitment to character. Yeah. And this is a, and you know, my son Dan, who I worked on the show with, created the show with, he came to me with an idea for this wealthy family that loses its money. But he also came to me because the sensibility of the movies that Chris and I were doing, that's kind of the sensibility that he wanted. Looking for in the show, and that's what we started, you know, kind of working with.
It's good he had connections with you.
It didn't hurt.
Yeah.
It didn't hurt, let's put it that way. But to his credit, he would never, ever, he spent 8 years on MTV.
Mm-hmm.
In Canada as a host and doing live stuff and doing it very well and very writing funny sketches and doing some great work. But I never thought that the big question was, would he be able to do something like this, a half hour comedy, a character that is got to be a genuine character, you know, and writing and, and honestly, anyway, long story short, he's great. He's quite brilliant at it. And I just love watching him work. And he's got a character our show that is insanely funny.
And you must be proud.
Yeah. Yeah. Dad's proud. Very
good.
Proud.
Good.
Yeah. Extremely.
Well, look, man, it was great talking to you and I'm happy that you're going and you're doing great work and congratulations on the new season.
Well, thank you, and I can't believe I'm finally here in this illustrious garage here. And as I've seen the pictures and kind of said, I wonder what it's like to be across the desk.
How was
from it, Mr. Maron? It's delightful. It's a great conversation. I never heard action.
Yeah, no, I don't do that.
Uh huh. So I take it. We're are we ready to go? Or
yeah,
was this just preamble?
That was all. We're about to start.
Oh, great, great. Okay,
thanks, man.
Thanks.
I enjoyed that. It was a pleasure meeting him. I like hearing the history. You know, I do. I can breathe. I'm just gonna take it in. I'm fear free right now. Fear free. Fear-free zone.
Boomer lives!